Welcome to Conversations with Alan Wolper, a half hour featuring unique personalities whose ideas are on the cutting edge. Alan Wolper is an award-winning journalist and a professor at Rutgers Newark. And now, Conversations with Alan Wolper.
Once a Marine, always a Marine. Nancy Chalero spent a year in Iraq. She returned home a wounded warrior. Now she is sharing her experience with the other men and women who have served tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, trying to rebuild their lives from the mental and physical wounds they suffered in those wars. Nancy, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Tell us your story first.
Well, I joined the Marine Corps in 2003. I was 23 years old at the time, and I wasn't really doing much in college. And I was on my way home from New York City after partying all night. So this big, huge sign that said 1-800-MARINES with this strikingly handsome good man, good-looking man on the poster. And I was like, you know, I think I'm going to join the Marine Corps. And I went to the recruiter station right there in Yonkers across county. And I was thinking, I was like, well, maybe I'll let me try Navy, because at that time they were right next door to each other. So I went to go towards Navy, and it was closed. They were closed for lunch. So the Marine recruiter, he was like, you want to be a Marine? I was like, I do. He's like, you do. That was about April 15th, April 14th, April 21st. I was in the Yellow Footsteps on Parris Island, ready to be a Marine.
Yellow what?
Yellow Footprints.
What does that mean?
When you show up to Parris Island, you're called poolies and recruits at that time. So you show up all discombobulated about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. You don't know where you are. And you have to stand in these yellow footsteps at attention and stand there while they're all yelling at you. And that's your first welcome to Parris Island, South Carolina.
And when did you wind up in overseas in Iraq?
I came home. I graduated from boot camp and I came home. I wasn't even home more than a year yet. And our unit got activated.
And home was where?
Home was in Westchester, New York. And I knew my unit was deploying. I wasn't supposed to go. Because when they deploy, a whole unit doesn't necessarily go. So my orders were to stay at home. But one of my sergeants, for some other reasons, wasn't able to go. So we were all deploying on Sunday. Friday night, I was told by my gunnery sergeant I had to pack up and go to Iraq in less than 48 hours.
Tell me, what was that like when you realized you're going to Iraq?
My stomach was in my feet. I didn't know what to do. I was so stunned. I had to go home and tell my whole family and try to tell everyone that I love them and say goodbye in a matter of 48 hours to go deploy and fight a war that mentally I wasn't ready for yet, because my mind wasn't in it. You know, I knew I was a Marine. This is what I was trained to do. But, you know, they didn't even warn me yet. So it was really difficult to do that, especially to my family. Because they had no time to hug and kiss me and no parties, goodbye. I had none of that.
Your father, your mother?
My mother hasn't been around since I was a child, but my father, my grandmother. And me and my father have always been at odds. Yeah, of course, you know, I'm the youngest, the only girl.
And how many
I have
brothers?
Two brothers, and we're all a year apart, and I was the only one to become a Marine or to join the military, period. So my father, he's very old school Italian, shall we say that. He didn't believe that I should be a Marine. He didn't believe that women should be doing stuff like that. So you can imagine his surprise when his little girl was like, hey, Dad, I'm going to be a Marine Corps.
And I'm going to Iraq.
What
did he say when he found out you went to Iraq?
He didn't say much. He just said he loved me and he wanted me to be careful. And, you know, he was like, I told you this was going to happen. You know, and he was just really upset. He, you know, I mean, I can't imagine what he felt like, because here I am. I'm a 24-year-old female, but he's still looking at me as a 2-year-old child. You know, he's still looking at me as his baby, and I can't imagine what he had to go through, my poor father.
A daughter, it's different than a son. I know, I have them.
Yeah, it definitely is a different kind of love.
So you wind up in Iraq.
So I show up in Kuwait, which was our staging station, and for about 2 weeks until we went into Al Asad, Iraq, which at that time was a green zone. And everything was fine. You know, I was doing my job. I actually loved being there. I loved being with my Marines.
What were you doing? What was your job?
I was an embarkation logistics specialist. So that's a really fancy word for saying that I move cargo back and forth.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. And, you know, the Marines have these fancy, fancy words, and that's fine. It makes me feel special. But That's what I did. So I got to see a lot of the country, and I got to go to a lot of the FOBs, which is the forward operating bases. We were in Fallujah for Phantom Fury in 04, November of 04, which is a sight to see. You know, I know it was all over the news. But and we've spoken before. It's a little bit different than it is now. These guys that are coming home, that they're able to make phone calls and emails. We didn't have any of that. So it was mostly just letters. And all of my letters were, everything's great, having a great time, you know, taking time off, you know, relaxing. And that was a complete lie to my family, because I personally didn't have the heart to tell them what was really going on.
Which was
we were being mortared every other day, getting mortar attacked. I mean, Fallujah was, it was really scary, you know, engaging with the enemy, you know, Marines dying. It's
to you watching all this.
Yeah, this is, you know, this is war. It's a reality.
Do people don't know what war is? They see, you know, it's really funny, all these movies and things bouncing up and down and people dying, but they come back in the next movie. This is real.
It's not Rambo where you're ripping throats out of people. I'll tell you, it's not like that at all. It's heart-wrenching. It's because you're seeing a different culture, and we're fighting these people. And it kind of makes you feel bad, but you hate them at the same time. Like, you don't know how to feel about being in this country and living with these people, that they just want to live a life.
Did you feel like you were liberating them at all? That was the...
Not at all.
Not at all.
No.
I felt
that I was terrorizing them. That's what I honestly felt like, that we were terrorizing them. You know, we come into their country and we, you know, it was, you know, everything was in shambles. I mean, we did help them. I mean, that's what we were trying to do. But here you have this beautiful culture, and it's so old, and they're so set in their ways. It was really hard for them to adjust to people, especially women.
I was just about to thinking about that. There are no women in the Iraq Army.
I mean, there are women, but they're covered up. They're not allowed to speak. You don't open doors for them. So me even speaking to an Iraqi, it was really hard for him to conversate with me, because he wasn't used to speaking to a woman like that, especially that I was, you know, authority. You know, he didn't want to take, you know, rules from me.
How about the other guys in the units you were in? How did they deal with you?
No, you know what? I have to say, I never had an issue with my Marines, probably because I'm a New Yorker and I'm so outspoken. No one ever really messed with me.
My Marines, huh?
And I say it proudly. I mean, I loved my guys and the one field that I served with, but I never had that issue. My unit, I happen to go with that unit that I serve with up at my base. So we were very tight-knit. So I was treated just like a Marine.
So there you are, there are bombs falling everywhere, and then there was one that fell near you.
Yeah, towards the end of my deployment, I had about 28 days, what we call 28 days in a wake-up.
Getting short,
exactly, a short calendar. But about 28 days, I had to go home. So it was in February, and I was at the fuel farm, which is our gas station.
February 2004 or 2005?
2005.
Okay.
I was at a gas station, and I was fueling my deuce in half, which is kind of like a truck. And, next thing I knew, a blast occurred. I was thrown, and I woke up because my feet were burning. I blacked out. I don't remember what happened. I just remember hearing an echo in my ears. And next thing I know, I was waking up because my feet were hot. Because the fires, they had hit our fuel bladders, and when we're talking about thousands of gallons of diesel fuel burning. I mean, they hit us really good that day, and the black smoke was burning for hours, and the fires were just so hot. And we were really close, me and my partner.
And who was your partner, male, female?
He was a male, and I was actually his senior by 3 months, so that made me his senior. But he was a great partner to have.
And what happened? Did he grab at you?
I actually fell towards him. Because it blasted through to both of us. We were both outside in the back. And the Iraqi at the time, we had gas attendants there. I guess you would call a gas attendant. He was severely hurt. And I had smacked my head so bad that I had some cuts on my head. And I definitely had some cuts and some gaping wounds on my arm. Because I put my hand up as, I guess, a protection. I didn't realize that I did that. But your body goes in that survival mode. So when we finally woke up, because the fire was so hot.
How long were you out?
Neither one of us knows.
So both of you were.
Both of us, yeah, got knocked out. It was such an explosion that It was really bad.
What's happened to him?
He was fine. I think that I mostly shielded him because he was standing in front of me and I was speaking to him, and the blast came from behind me. So it threw me into him and threw us both. And that's how strong it was. And it actually threw both of our bodies away.
That's when you became a wounded warrior, Nancy Schillero, now a part of the Wounded Warriors Project. And you came home.
I came home. I came home in 2005, March 2005.
But you still didn't realize that the toughest part of your rehabilitation was yet to come.
No, the whole time that I was in Iraq, your body goes into survival mode, so you don't have any feelings. So when you come home, not only was I dealing with the mental feelings of the guilt, the anger, all these crazy feelings were going through my body, but now I have this physical disability as a 25-year-old female, the loss of a right eye.
I don't think anybody's know. You have to tell that story about what happened. You had some headaches.
I started seeing some black floaters. And at the time, and people aren't going to know this, there's no hospitals in Iraq. Our hospital consists of a cot and a syringe and some Tylenol. That's a hospital for us. You're in the middle of the desert. You have nothing unless you get medevaced out of somewhere. And if nothing is falling off your body per se, they're not going to medevac you out of there. Especially if you say you're fine, which I was fine. I had some cuts and some scrapes. I had a huge headache, but of course, I just got blown up. But none of my limbs were falling off. I mean, my eye didn't pop out of my head.
So you're home, and you go to a doctor, and what do they tell you?
Go home, go to the doctor, and they couldn't figure out what was wrong with me.
Headaches?
They gave me medication for my headaches. My eye at this time was completely tearing and getting all bloodshot, and the infection was spreading. They thought it was pink eye, so they gave me medication for pink eye. Then I went back and I was like, something is wrong because now I'm losing my sight. So something is not right in there. And the headaches are persisting. I mean,
how's your family handling all this?
They walked on eggshells with me. So I took myself a lot to the doctor's appointments. I didn't want them knowing what was going on with me.
And then what happened finally when they operated?
Finally, after I got a couple of operations, I lost all sight, light perception and everything. But I wanted to keep my eyeball itself. We had about four or five operations to save the eyeball. I knew I was never going to have my sight back. Then my doctor came in. He was like, the infection is spreading so fast. You have one choice. Remove the eye or you're going to be blind in both eyes. So they had to inoculate the eye November 15th, 2005.
And now you're telling the story to lots of other people, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of stories are you hearing from returning vets? What kind of problems are they facing?
They're facing all sorts of problems with their PEB and MEB, which is their medical discharge and trying to get out retired. And I can completely, I can understand where they're coming from because I had a hard time as well. Not that the VA is a bad system. It's not. I'm not going to sit here and bash the VA. But it's just like any organization, when you have an overflood of people coming home, I don't think they were prepared,
And especially the number of women. I mean, I've read that now we used to have maybe a couple of thousand. Now we're talking about hundreds of thousands of women around. The last statistics I saw, those women were enlisting at a much higher rate than men.
And we all know that women need different services than men when they come on home, as far as their body goes. So when I first came home, it was difficult to find those kind of doctors because, again, there weren't many women coming home from the military with injuries.
This is 2005.
This was 2005. And they've gotten a lot better. But it was trial and error for the VA for a while. They were just overflooded.
The politicians come back. I mean, it's a presidential year and everybody's saying, we're going to get jobs for all these veterans. And the word is that people are a little uncomfortable about hiring ex-vets. They're worried about them. I guess they're worried about all kinds of things that have nothing to do with who they are.
I'll be honest with you, my experience with employers and we work with a lot of companies because we do it at Wounded Warrior Project. I haven't had that experience. Thank God. Not me personally. They look at these guys that are in the military. And most of these employers want military guys because they have integrity. They have discipline. They have respect. They
have a military occupational specialty. But a lot of them come back without limbs. And it's probably hard for them to look at.
Yeah, you do have that. But I think it's a different era in these times as well. It wasn't like it was back then that nobody wanted to bother with us. There is help out there. There are people that want to do this. I mean, I know guys that are New York City firefighters that lost a leg. You know, and I'm proud to say that, you know, they're an Iraqi veteran.
So now, so it's much different now in 2012 than it was, let's say, 2005 and 6.
It was. As far as services, it was. Because, you know, initial invasion was in 2003. You know, I think they probably thought this was going to be another desert storm, you know, only about a week long. You know, and that's not what it was. You know, these guys were actually coming home alive. We have better Kevlar on where we're coming home alive. We're not coming home. We're coming home with traumatic brain injuries and PTSD, which the VA is finding hard to understand.
Post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Yes.
Post-traumatic stress syndrome. Did you have it? Do you have it now?
Yes, I do.
What is that like?
It's a battle every day. It's actually one of the only diseases that will get worse in time and not better.
Well, how do you handle it? What is it? Well, how does it manifest itself?
For the first 2 years of my life, I couldn't leave my bedroom. It's a feeling of despair. There's so many feelings that go inside you, especially the guilt and the horrific things that you've done in your life.
Guilt? Why guilt?
Because I came home and my brothers didn't, my sisters didn't. And why them and not me, or why me and not them?
So you lost some good friends out there.
Yes.
And you watched some of them die and get wounded. And
yeah.
I don't think any of us can understand that.
No, it's like how to, you just ask yourself, you know, like, why, you know, it's hard. Like, why me? Why did I come home? And then you go through where it's like, maybe losing my eye was my punishment. Maybe God's punishing me. You go through all these, and it sounds ridiculous that I'm speaking to you right now and saying this to you, but that's what I was going through.
It's your fault, huh?
These are irrational thoughts that I was having in my head while I'm sitting in my room with all this idle time. I had to have a reason why this happened to me. I had to have a reason, and I still to this day don't have a reason.
Why not?
Why should
you be apologizing for the fact that you're here sitting with me now? I mean, you've put in your time.
I put in my time just like they did, but they didn't get to come home to their family. And maybe that makes me appreciate life that much more. I did get to come home to my family, and I cherish every day with them.
But don't you have the opportunity when through the Wounded Warriors Project to talk to a lot of people who probably wouldn't be able to talk to someone like you if you hadn't been here?
And I tell them all the time, you know, like, you can take your experience and you can be negative about it or you can be positive. For almost 3 years, I was completely negative about it. Today, now, I'm here to be positive for all those guys and girls coming home. Take the example from me. You can turn this experience into a positive thing. Like, just like I'm doing every day. Yes, I struggle every day I wake up in the morning. But instead of waking up saying, oh, I just want to go back to bed, or I don't want to live anymore, I wake up saying, what new thing am I going to encounter today? What am I going to learn? Who am I going to meet? You know, and listen, not every day is a good day. There are still plenty of days where I will stay in the bed because I just physically cannot get out. But that's what I have to deal with. That's my cross to bear. That's my burden.
What do they tell you when they come home? What is the thing, the overwhelming problem that these veterans are having, male and female, as they come back?
I'm not normal anymore. I'm not me anymore. I don't know who I am. Of course you're not normal anymore. You just went to war. What you're feeling is a normal reaction to an abnormal situation. If you came home to me and you said, you know what, oh, I feel great, you're the guy I would worry about. Because I want you to, you have to have feelings. You're only a human being. You're not a robot. You know, you're going to go through these feelings. But instead of thinking of it as a bad, like, oh, you're right, you are a new you. But you're a new better you. We are 1% of this country, and you better hold your head up high, because we paid a high price to get into this fraternity that we're in. And I'm proud to hold my head up high and say, you know what? I'm 1% of this country that served their country with honor. And that's the way I want you to feel. Don't feel that you disrespected your country. Don't feel that you're not worth living. Don't feel any of that.
How do you get through to them?
Some you don't. And that's just the reality. That's the world that we live in, dealing with veterans. The sad reality is, you know, we deal with lives on a daily basis. And the ones you get through to, you go home and you sit back and you be like, you know, give yourself a pat on the back. The ones you don't get through, you can't take it personal, and you have to sit there and just say, I did my best.
Give me a success story.
Severa Rodriguez. I don't know if I'm allowed to say her name, but
that's okay.
She was a girlfriend of mine. We met on a Project Odyssey when I was still in my healing process.
And Project Odyssey is part of Wounded Warriors Project.
Yes. It's a PTSD combat stress retreat, and it's either all female, all male. And I actually run them to this day. But the first one I went on was in 2008 because I was suffering from, you know, my PTSD. And I met her, and she was the only Marine.
You know what? I want you to use that term so people hear it. Not PTSD. Why don't you say post-traumatic stress syndrome? I'm reading it.
It's post-traumatic stress disorder.
Good. A disorder. Excuse me.
Yeah, it's okay. It's okay. But it's a post-traumatic stress disorder combat stress retreat.
And so they're hearing from Nancy Schillero of the Wounded Warriors Project, and they're looking at you, and you're telling them what? You're telling her what?
We went on our odyssey together, and we remained friends. When I started working for Wounded Warrior Project doing Project Odysseys, I saw she was still struggling, and I wanted to help her.
Where was she from? She a Marine, an Army?
She was a Marine. She's from San Antonio, Texas. And I brought her onto another odyssey with me, and I spoke to her, and I sat her down, and I said, you know, as a friend, you know, strictly as a friend, as a Marine, however you want to look at me right now, but what can I do to make your life a little bit better? Like, what do you need me to do?
What happened to her?
She had went on over, and she experienced some pretty hard times over there for what she saw.
Iraq.
The things that she had to deal with, and she just... It wasn't catching with her. She couldn't get out of her rut. And I needed to help her. So I helped myself and Wounded Warrior Project put her back in school with our track program, which is a year-long program that Wounded Warrior Project does to get these guys and girls back into college and school and educating them. And then, you know, she was my success story. Like, I looked at her, and now she's on all of our billboards, and she speaks just like I do to other males and females that are coming home. And it just feels good that I can go home and say, I did that.
You did that.
I did that.
What about the ones you can't? Why can't you get to certain people? What is it that they're bringing home that we, those of us who are in civilian life and never had to deal with this, can't understand? What don't we understand about what you went through?
You know, people think coming home from the war, they think of physical injuries, losing a leg, losing an arm. That's what they think. Oh, you're wounded. You lost a body part. It's so easy to get a new leg, you know, as a prosthetic leg or a prosthetic arm. You know, it is. You can fix that. How do you fix a broken soul? I mean, there's no Band-Aids. There's no medication to fix that, or a broken mind. And this is what America and civilians need to understand. These guys and girls coming home, their minds and their hearts are severely broken. And they cannot find the will, or they don't know how to fix it. And that's what people need to understand about these men and women coming home. It's not that they're stupid. They're not stupid. It's not that they're lazy because they don't want to work. It's not that. Their bodies physically cannot heal themselves.
Does it have anything to do with the fact that the country was split on the war, on whether we needed to go to war?
It does. Because you're going over there. And you don't know why you're going over there. You're going over there because you signed the contract, and you're an honorable person, and you will live up to what you signed. And again, you know, it's just like, what am I fighting here for? What am I here for? You know? And then you start thinking, you know why I'm here? I'm here for the guy to the right and left of me. That's why I'm here. And that's what gets you through those days.
That's the old training. I remember it well.
Yeah. It still works to this day.
We did that in the Army as well. Your buddy next to you, take care of him, he'll take care of you.
Exactly, and that's what you live for, and that gets you through your days. But now that you don't have that when you come home, you don't have that camaraderie, what do?
Are you nervous about the fact that you are blind in one eye? Does that affect you?
Yes, it does. I'm a single female, and I think about it all the time. Who's going to want me? You know, how am I going to explain this to my child, or how am I going to explain this to a man that wants to date me that I'm a combat veteran and I have a prosthetic eyeball? It's not very, I mean.
Can't tell.
No, you can't tell, but I know it's there. You know, that's a physical disability that I have to tell somebody. And not that I'm not proud of it, but I have to take the Marine out of me. I'm still a female. I'm still a woman. You know, I want to be loved just like everybody else. It's not as cool to have scars when you're a female.
Not as cool.
No.
But there are men in your life, I assume.
Oh, of course.
So?
Oh, I mean, like as my dating life? No, I don't have anyone in my life right now.
Not right now.
Not right now.
Well, tell us more about what you think you need to do, and what people like Pat Cataldo have to do running the Wounded Warrior Project in New York. What do you guys do every day?
Every day we're reaching out to warriors, we're planning events for them and thinking about what's going to make them feel their new norm. And I say that in quotation marks because whatever their new norm is going to be. And this is what I work tirelessly on, and all of us at Wounded Warrior Project does, planning these odysseys so these guys feel that camaraderie again. They get the tools that they need to be proactive in their healthcare.
Proactive in their healthcare. What does that mean?
The help is out there.
We're talking about in their minds.
In their minds. The help is out there. The tools are there.
You feel like the VA is not what it was once before when it was very controversial. There are more people willing to talk to you, to treat you.
Oh, definitely. Of course, yes. They welcome you with open arms. You have the OIF, OEF coordinators, all the VAs that welcome as soon as they find out that you're an Iraq or Afghanistan veteran.
Have you had difficulty talking to some people who just didn't like the war in Iraq and blamed you for being there?
Yes, you do get that. Unfortunately, you do. I mean, I don't know about anybody else. Me personally, I am in the public eye a lot, so I do get that.
People in the media, I would.
I'm just saying.
My God, we're laughing about this. No, I mean, I wonder if you on radio or TV shows where you have anchors and news people like me who just don't like you because of where you were.
No, I haven't. I've had people in the street say things to me, but you just.
What do they say?
Oh, how could you do it? How could you fight over there? Because, you know, and I just think of their ignorance.
Like, who are they?
Oh, well, civilians, like when we do parades sometimes or if we're at an event. I mean, sometimes you get one guy who wants to, or a girl who wants to speak to you, and the conversation will always go that way. Oh, why did you feel you have to do that? Or do you think you were right by going over there? And yes, I do think I was right because, like I said, I'm an honorable person. And I signed the contract to serve my country. My country told me I had to go to war. I packed my gear and I went to war.
What do people in Iraq and Afghanistan feel about this whole war now that they've come back? What do they tell you?
The Iraqis or?
I mean, no, American servicemen. I mean, you see them from Iraq and Afghanistan, and there's all these controversies about whether we should be there or not be there. And nobody really knows what the story is. We don't even read in the newspapers or see on television. Once in a while, we see a Nancy Shalera, but we don't. We don't see very much of you guys.
No.
Why not? What are we doing wrong?
I don't know. You know what it is? I've always looked at the media with a bit of a scowl on my face because every time I look at the media, I see the horrible things that we're doing over there. You know, like, I'm sure you know the article about that Marine urinating on the dead body. But what they don't show you is what that poor young kid had to go through before he did that, what he's experiencing the whole time he was in Iraq or Afghanistan before he did something horrible like that. And yes, it was horrible. I'm not defending him. They don't want to show you the good of it. They want to show you the bad because that's what people feed off of. And that's just reality. People feed off the bad in war. And every so often, hopefully, Wounded Warrior Project and myself get on in there and we show them the good in war, like myself or like the warriors that I work in. You know what? And that's the good in war. Look what this kid is doing now. Look what he never thought. He's got no legs, but he's skiing.
No, it's funny. At baseball and football stadium, all these people get up and they chant USA, USA, but I don't think they really mean it, to tell you the truth.
I don't think it's not that they don't really mean it. I'm sure they mean it, but how are they supposed to really understand it unless they've been there? You know, it's very heartfelt, and I believe that the American population really supports their veterans, but it's a burden that we bear for them. It's a cross that we bear for them. So you know what? I don't want them to know what my pain is, but I do want them to extend their hand and thank me.
Tell them one last time what you think they should do as we're coming to the end of this broadcast.
You know what? When they see a veteran, the only thing that I can say is extend your hand and thank them. You know, welcome them home because that's what they want to hear. Don't ask them any questions. You know, just say, you know what? Welcome home, buddy. Slap them on the back. You know, say a nice kind word to them because these men and women are really broken spirited and sometimes they just need their spirits to be lifted.
Just a small thank you?
Just a small thank you and a welcome home. That's it. And it's all it takes to make some poor guy's or girl's day.
It does.
Yeah. And I knew it used to make my day.
People actually did that for you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, your story is very inspiring and very interesting. I want to thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
Our Story Here is produced by Joanna Walper, who's our senior producer, and Doug Doyle is our news director. Inga Korsgaard is our photographer. And you can get any part of this program, once again, if you go to WBGO.org or Jazz88 or any of the other places that we find ourselves in, mobile, on the air, or online. See you next week here on Conversations with me, Alan Walper.
special thanks to Phantom Audio, a full-service production studio in New York's Flatiron District. And support for Conversations with Alan Wolper has been provided by the Blanche and Irving Laurie Foundation.